Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 29th of July, 2014. On the call today, we have Tatiana Krumstova, Graham Bunton, James Bladell, Steve Medelitz, Alex Deacon, Michaela Nyland, Roy Beliste, Susan Kawaguchi, Sarah Wild, Chris Pelling, Griffin Barnett, Justin Macy, Darcy Southwell, Pat Williams, Val Sherman, Osvaldo Nueva, Libby Bainey, Don Blumenthal, Frank McKellick, Paul McGrady, Volker Greeman, Kathy Kleiman, and Phil Morano. We have apologies from Tobias Sattler, Holly Rage, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, and Stephanie Perrin. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, and myself, Terry Agnew. I also see that Susan Prosser has joined us as well. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Don.
I appreciate it. I'm going to make a request before I get going. I seem to be the eternally headset-challenged person in ICANN. So I'm experimenting with ways of muting my system. Please let me know if what I do is creating background noise. Send me a text or whatever, but let me get this figured out. Any event, it's just as I was about to comment on how last week's email list had been so active and this week's had not. I opened email this morning, and suddenly that wasn't the case anymore. So I really appreciate the everybody's involvement. It's great, really important for moving us along to keep the conversation going in between. In between discussions. And if nobody heard mute come on that time, then I think I got it figured out. Heard mute come on, that's a little bit of an oxymoron, but I'll move on. Normally, I would start off with returning to last week's subjects, but I think we've kind of begun that in the discussion that's gone on yesterday and this morning. So I think generally let's move on with E1. I'm not sure if we'll have time to get to E2 given how things have picked up. I'll be honest with you, I'm frantically looking for a draft of something I had yesterday that's disappeared. Just flat out ask, Steve, did you get my message about forwarding?
I did, and I resent, but I'll do it again.
Please. Sorry about this. Okay, I seem to be having some problems with my email program here. Let's see. Okay, Steve or Graham, could you remind me what was number one, and then everything else come back to play in place?
This is Steve Metalitz. I think the first question that we had left from last time was this issue about an email message is sent for relay, and it's relayed and it bounces back as undeliverable. So the first question was that I think we had not fully resolved was, is the provider supposed to notify the submitter of that bounce back?
Yes, and as you were talking, both of your follow-ups showed up. So I appreciate it. The gremlins are here. I listened to the transcript, listened to the recording, read the transcript, and have looked at the follow-up on the email list. And, want to see where we are on the question of if email bounces back, does the submitter have to know? I saw comparisons to the RAA requirements, but I guess the question is, are they comparable? Because as I think has been pointed out, the requester, the submitter, for lack of however we want to call it, knows if there's been a failure. In the case of a registration that's in the open, the submitter doesn't know if there's a failure. If it goes through a proxy privacy, and should that be different? And I want to clarify, I think there might have been some confusion last week on what we were talking about. It looked to me as if some people were responding to the question whether there should be, what happens if there's a failure of email to the proxy privacy service. And I don't think that's what we're addressing. We're addressing a failure of a message from the P2P privacy proxy to the registrant, or the beneficial registrant, however we want to put it. Any thoughts on where we are there? Or where we should be? Steve?
This is Steve Metalitz. Our view is that the requester or submitter should be notified in that situation. Again, as you said, that puts them on the same footing as in a non-proxy situation. They know that the beneficial registrant or the customer or whatever you want to call it has not received the message. So then they can figure out what else to try to do to contact them. But without that, they don't know. They just have sent something out. And they haven't received any response, which may, as several people have pointed out, simply mean that the registrant chose not to respond.
Okay, thanks. I think James is early on this issue. I'll hand it over.
Thanks, Don. James speaking for the transcript. And understanding the scenario here where a third party has sent a message to the privacy service or relay. Privacy service has attempted to relay to the email address that is non-public email address that it maintains for a customer, and that email address, that email bounces or is somehow undeliverable. Just a couple of quick thoughts here. First off, if we're going to align this with the equivalent procedure in the RAA, then the trigger on this, the triggered event would be that the privacy proxy service would then have to contact their customer and re-verify the information that they have on file. That is currently the obligation that we have if a verified email address bounces either with an ICANN message or any other required communication. So I think that is definitely something that we should require. However, to my understanding, I don't know of any requirement or obligation under the RAA that would require us to report that happening to a third party aside from ICANN compliance, not the sender or any other third party. And I just wanted to point out that bouncing of email messages or undeliverable email failures could result from a number of situations that are not related to the email address being invalid. For example, there could be an email server on the receiving end might be down, or the mailbox may be full, or the the privacy proxy service may have been tripped up. Something in the message itself may have been tripped up by a spam filter. If you use a keyword, for example, that is triggering a spam filter that thinks it's a solicitation or some adult material or something like that. So there's a number of reasons why something could fail and be unrelated to the validity of the email address. Thank you.
Volker?
I basically agree with everything that James said. I'm trying to keep the workload as light as possible, but still be reasonable with the information that the complainant deserves. And I think it's not as easy as I immediately thought. I wrote my responses last week because if the complainant is not informed that the message has bounced, then he would be under the assumption that the recipient has at least received in some form the communication, and that would not be the case if it bounced. However, the message bouncing would trigger all kinds of different things, and I would suggest that any proxy email that bounced would trigger the re-verification process, as is the case with a registrar at the moment. And then once the data has been fixed, then the message would be relayed again. That would be the course that I see. I don't see a necessity of immediately having to inform the complainant that the message has bounced, but it might be something that is worthwhile looking at again down the road when the information when the data has been fixed or not fixed, and the domain name. The actions have been taken by the privacy provider with regard to the invalid address.
Appreciate it. Yeah, the lessons there raised answer to the question I was thinking about tossing into the mix. But I'll wait now. Alex?
Yeah, hi. So I just wanted to understand, I guess, James' point a little better. This is Alex Deacon for the record. The re-verification step that registrars and privacy proxies perhaps need to do is a mechanism between the privacy proxy or the registrar and the end user. But I think that's different than the use case that I have in mind, at least if I understand things correctly. And this is an email from someone on the outside being sent through the privacy proxy service to the registrant. If that bounces, it seems to make sense to me that this bounce notification, and I understand there's lots of reasons why things will fail, I'd suggest that they all make it back to the original requester. It seems to me that these are different mechanisms. So I'm not too sure the 2013 RAA is kind of in effect in this use case. Any clarification you may have would be appreciated. Thanks.
Okay. Let's move on. Michele?
Michele for the record. I'm not addressing the previous question because I can't really, because I wasn't the one who was dealing with it. Just another thought that kind of struck my mind around bounce messages is that there are privacy implications with that, because it would give quite a bit of information potentially about somebody's mail server on the far side. Now, that might not be a major issue, but at the same time, could see that as being a potential issue. Thanks.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, by bounce in this context, I'm talking about, say, soft bounces as opposed to hard bounces.
Okay, you want to clarify the distinction?
Yeah, sorry. A soft bounce could be when the mail server on the far side cannot process the mail for a number of reasons, such as the mailbox is full, the mailbox is unavailable, or the mail server is having some kind of technical issue. But a soft bounce message could include a whole load of information about the server on the far side. This would not, eventually the mail may be relayed, but you'd still get the error in the interim, because it's a four star code error as opposed to a five star. If you speak fluent SMTP, thanks.
I didn't know it was its own language. James, did you have your hand up?
No, Kelly, I think covered it, and others have as well. I think I'm good.
Okay, just want to make sure it came down on purpose. That's all. Steve?
I think the more relevant question is whether it went up on purpose. Definitely came down on purpose.
Oh, okay. I'll leave the other one for people to guess. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalis. Let me get back to James's point about this triggering re-verification. If there's such a confusion about what's a soft bounce, what's a hard bounce, what's four digits, what's five digits, when does the re-verification obligation kick in? And let me just take it in the non-proxy situation. If the registrar sends who is reminder notice or something else to the address that's given, the email address that's given and who is, and it bounces back, that presumably triggers the obligation to re-verify under the 2013 RAA. So is there difficulty in determining when that applies? Or is there a way to determine when that happens, and why couldn't that same test be applied here? In other words, when you're forwarding to the address given by the registrar. So I just posed that to James or others from the registrar community, who somehow seem to find it very difficult to determine when there's been a bounce back.
Okay. I saw James' hand shoot up right there. Let me ask, is Volker or James, do you want to respond? Your hand came up quickly. Do you want to respond to that point?
This is James speaking. I think if I understood the question, and I'm sorry if I didn't, the question I heard at the end was, do registrars have difficulty determining when a bounce has occurred? I think that answer is usually no. If we are watching for it, we can determine that a bounce has occurred. If it's something that is being tracked, I would state, however, that it is the capturing of that and then the making the determination of whether or not a third party would have rights to the information that contained in the bounce message, or, as McKelly said, we probably may have privacy implications on sending the raw bounce message, because it may give away some aspects, some valuable, in fact, vulnerabilities about the mail server. And then the additional point being that, just the fact that the bounce occurred at all, does that, is there a right of visibility by third parties, to that event? And I guess my question is, I'm trying to understand why there would be. I'm trying to get my mind around.
I don't understand my question, James. So
then I probably don't. Steve, can you help me?
Let me ask if I can clarify. Leave the third party out of this. This has nothing to do with third parties. The question I'm asking is, under the WHOIS accuracy program specification, if the registrar has any information suggesting that the contact information is incorrect, such as registrar receiving a bounced email notification or non-delivery notification message in connection with compliance with ICANN's WHOIS data reminder policy, or otherwise. I mean, that's not the only circumstance, but that describes a circumstance in which you received a bounced email notification or non-delivery notification message. Now, why couldn't you apply that? In that case, you have to go then validate and re-verify. I mean, there's other things you have to do then. This is the trigger that you were talking about. Why couldn't that same test be applied in this case? And I just want to make sure that I'm understanding that the problem is not that you don't know when this happens. The problem is that you don't want to let the requester be put in the same position he would be in the non-proxy setting of knowing that it's happened.
So thanks for clarifying, Steve. I think we're in agreement that it should trigger that re-verification. But I think I do agree with your latter piece here, the last piece of your comment, is that I don't understand why it should be that when the proxy service is the listed contact in the public WHOIS database, that if the contact to that public WHOIS contact is successful, that any subsequent contacts, and there could be more than one, not just to that customer, but that customer could be a law firm or a web host or something else that's operating on behalf of yet another fourth party or something like that. And I'm saying that chain of visibility to that contact, success or failure, to my mind, ends once the contact is established successfully with the public WHOIS contact, and that any subsequent contacts after that are private communication.
Well, James, this explains to me why your policy states that you can that the customer can opt out of receiving any relay whatsoever. And I thought we decided last week that was not an appropriate standard and should not be allowed under our accreditation process. But you're basically saying there's no obligation to relay. Once I've sent it to the address that's given by the proxy service, that's it. That's all I'm entitled to. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that we're open to the idea that some parties are privileged, such as ICANN and the registrar, and perhaps law enforcement. And that's what we're discussing as part of this accreditation program.
But nobody else is entitled to have anything relayed, correct?
Well, I think we're going to shake that out, Steve, but my position is no. But there may be other, we may uncover other types of contacts or communications, you know, as we go forward. But off the cuff, it seems that, to me, those three, or perhaps the registry, would also be included.
No, and so no one else is entitled.
Okay,
I think
James made the point. I jumped Kathy, and I'd really like to get back to her. Kathy?
Hi, can you hear me, Don? Hello, everybody.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is not related, it's not directly related to what James and Steve were just talking about. So if you wanted to continue that, please do.
I just wanted to isolate that one question at the point. At that point, I think we went on into some other areas. Thanks.
Sure. Okay. Well, I wanted to take actually one kind of giant step back. Per some of the stuff I was putting in the chat room, I can definitely see why a requester would want to know if the email went through or if the message to the customer went through, to the proxy privacy customer. But I wanted to go back to the feasibility. How feasible is it to transmit all bounce-back messages back when we're dealing with automated systems? And I know we talked about it a little bit last time, and I apologize for the background noise here as the saws go on. My next door neighbor. But how feasible is it if we're dealing, we can envision that once this relay system is in place, it's going to be used a lot. And so a lot of messages going through, how easy is it to sort the bounce back messages in automated systems and get back to every requester when something bounces for all the different reasons that we've been talking about? Just on a feasibility side, how easy is that? And then we can go into the details. Similarly, if a courier package is forwarded on and bounces, you know, and doesn't go through, what about that? Or a fax message and they're out of paper on the other side. This seems like an awful lot of stuff to track, and I'm not even sure it's possible. So, again, key question, what's the initial feasibility? Thanks.
Well, no, I think Volker had wanted to jump in on the last conversation, so why don't you go to Volker and also ask if you, as a registrar, if you've got a thought on Kathy's question there.
I would have to think about that. It's a bit complicated. I was thinking about the previous discussion, so I didn't catch it all. Sorry for that. With regard to, I would like to just go to two points. One is the entitlement question, and I can see James's position. I support it that insofar that privacy provider at this point can choose what to forward to its customers and what not to. I think the question of what needs to be relayed is something that we are supposed to be discussing as part of this group. I'm not sure that we should be talking about an entitlement here. It's rather a question of what is appropriate. For our service, it's always been appropriate to forward email and nothing else, nothing but email. Automatically, if directed to the address in the WHOIS, and some of those that are sent to our abuse email as well. But that's the way we choose to operate our service. That's not because we think that one party or the other has an entitlement. The second point I wanted to go into was the question of bounces. And currently, the way the RAA is structured is we do not have to do anything if a bounce happens. We have to do something if we become aware that some information in the WHOIS is incorrect. For example, if there's a bounce that we can directly associate with an email address. So if we get a bounce message that tells us this email that we sent to this email address was wrong, was undeliverable, then we have to do something. If we receive a bounce that says there was a bounce, not sure which email that was, nothing else there, then we don't have to do anything. And that's a distinction I wanted to point out.
Okay, thanks. Interesting split there. James?
Hi, thanks. James speaking. Just Kathy's statement reminded me of something I think I read. Actually, I think I read it from Kathy on the list either yesterday or perhaps a couple days ago. The question about feasibility reminded me that she had asked a question about could a service, a proxy service, for example, offer to block, let's say, solicitations for the purchase of a domain name, but relay, you know, other types of communication. And it got me thinking a little bit that the real challenge here might be to relay or not relay and make that decision based on content rather than on the sender. And I was thinking about how difficult it would be just from an operational perspective to build a system that could make the determination what the content or intent of a communication was on an automated high-volume basis. And thinking a little bit about how that would could prompt, you know, like an arms race for, you know, spammers and other unwanted communication, trying to get around those filters that were making that determination. So it seems like the approach, at least from an implementation side, might be to, you know, identify senders or, you know, or other types of keywords, because I'm not sure that that can be built to be abuse-proof. Anyway, it was just something, I don't know if that directly answers your question, Kathy. It probably answers a different but related question, so sorry about that.
Thanks, James. I think to some extent we'll probably get into that type of discussion when we move on to E2. Alex?
Yeah, hi, it's Alex Deacon. Yeah, so I just wanted to comment on the question that Kathy posed regarding how difficult it is to do. I mean, SMTP is a protocol that's been around for a long time. I think it's people understand how it works. Just to mention a thread that's on the chat, it's not perfect, but emails that are sent, through forwarders and proxies and on, perhaps two or three layers deep. As long as these headers are properly maintained and mapped, then I think the response on the way back should be quite easy to track. And there's ways to do that. There's the to from headers, there's reply to headers. Proxies in the middle or mail forwarders in the middle can put X-dash headers. Their personal, if you will, headers to with global user IDs or global IDs to track requests and response. So, I don't think that's difficult to do. I've done that in a past life, and it happens every day today, and has for many years with SMTP. So I just wanted to raise the point that this isn't difficult. Sure, there are some edge cases that you have to deal with, but I don't think it's too challenging. It's definitely possible to do, and the fact that it's hard or perhaps a pain in the neck shouldn't be a reason to not do this.
Okay, Michele, I think we could go on because there are nuances to this kind of auto-forwarding type concept that could take us for a long time. Maybe take it back to the list. Do Michele, and then I want to move on to the next sub-questions for you on.
Michele, for the record, I'm not sure if I want to be done, but okay, thank you. Now, just in relation to communication methods, as somebody else mentioned, fax was mentioned a couple of times, and I think somebody else pointed out that the fax contact isn't an obligatory field, so I think it's best ignored. With respect to this entire email thing, we could end up in quite a circular conversation around that. My main concern is around whatever language ends up in a policy or a contract. Because I'm very wary of how it ends up being phrased. Because if you make it a binding obligation on registrars or privacy proxy providers to do certain things, that's very different to them making best efforts, etc. Because if we fail to relay a single message for some technical reason, then we're in breach of the contract, and that would not be very pleasant. The other thing is in relation to feasibility of doing things. I mean, at the moment we're currently exploring a service that we want to offer some of our clients, which would involve forwarding mail from one country to another. And the problem we've run into is working out how you can actually price it in the same fashion, because none of the companies that operate in that space will give you kind of blanket pricing. They won't even give us X number of items relayed sent per month in the pricing. So actually scoping out the cost becomes a major challenge. Just something to bear in mind. Thanks.
I appreciate it. I'm going to backtrack on something I said a minute ago. I hadn't realized until we looked at number three on my sub-questions how much we really have been covering all three. So I'd like to continue the thread, but I want to remind folks of the discussion concerning relaying of snail mail. I'm not sure there was agreement on whether it should be done or what kind of costs can be passed along to the submitter. And getting back a little bit to something James mentioned that I said was going to come up in E2, I think it might be appropriate here also, in the context of snail mail, what obligations are there to forward snail mail? How much in the way of cost can be passed along or not passed along? The other issue is the extent to which snail mail is going to present a separate set of issues with regard to being able to screen topic of message. It can be easy to see in an email what the subject is and whether it's really something that should be forwarded if we take that approach as opposed to the sender approach. But I'm not sure that's possible, at least under U.S. law, anyway, in the case of regular mail. So then let's keep this going, but I'd also like to spend a little bit of time focusing on paper mail, because, again, I don't think there was agreement last week on how that should be handled. Alex?
Sorry, that's an old hand.
Volker?
Yes, regarding paper mail, paper communications, I might be very controversial by saying that anything that is communicated by paper can also be communicated as an attachment to an email, and paper would require the provider to get up from his desk, go to the scanning machine, insert a USB, scan the damn thing in, hundreds of pages, whatever, go back to his desk, insert the email into his computer, and then send out an email to the registrant. I don't think that's practical. Anything, especially if you can just request somewhere in your terms and conditions that anything communications be sent by email. I think postal communications, in most cases, as most providers do, go directly to the trash can, and rightly so.
This is David Hughes. I'd like to speak next, if I could.
Sure. Yes, go ahead, David. David, you're breaking up pretty severely.
Okay. Good. Can you guys hear me now?
Sorry, the only... Okay, now, yeah, and when you asked if you could speak, nothing in between.
Okay, if you can't hear me, I'm sorry, but it's about the establishment of the physical location. It's not about sending hundreds of pages. A one-page letter with a link, please go to this website and click or something, would be enough. But in law enforcement and IP enforcement, our last line of, our last recourse is usually trying to establish the physical location. And if the emails and electronic communication did not work and we can't establish a physical, then I have to question the purpose of who is, at least for certain purposes, including law enforcement.
Okay.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Let me just clarify. Are you suggesting that paper mail... I mean, what we're talking about here is, say, forwarding a paper mail that came in to... the proxy privacy service. Are you suggesting that the service would send something else in via paper about clicking a link, as opposed to just forwarding the message itself?
Well, if there's no response to any electronic communication from the end client, then there's no chain. There's no chain to the, I don't understand the purpose who is if you can't get to the end of the chain, if you can't get to the
the user. I'm not sure you guys would call it a user in the case of a client, customer, in the case of the privacy proxy. Alex, maybe you can articulate my concern better if you share it.
Yeah, this is Alex. I'm having a hard time following myself, David. I apologize.
Okay. Okay, maybe I'll write something up and share it with you. Scenario that I'm thinking of. Better use of our time than talking about it on the phone.
Okay, thanks. Steve?
Yeah, Steve Metallitz here. I just want to say I think the issue on that we've been talking about on snail mail or hard copy, if you will, is really just the situation that David is talking about. We're not talking about it's a situation where there's been an attempt to relay an email and, for example, it's bounced or it's been undeliverable. In that case, Volcker's argument that anything you could send by hard copy, you could also send attached to the email is not relevant because we've tried to send it by email and that email doesn't work. In that circumstance, the question is whether there would then be an obligation to forward it to the mailing address that the provider has been given. So I think it's a much narrower circumstance than saying anything that comes in via snail mail has to be forwarded. Although I noted last week on the call that a number of providers already say they do that. But leaving that aside, I'd like to focus on the narrow case where there's been an attempt to send via email. The email has been undeliverable, and should in that case there be a requirement to forward snail mail or hard copy if the requester asks for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. That's David.
David?
I just wanted to thank Steve for clarifying my position. Yeah, I think this is when every other, you know, when all electronic communication has failed and we have no recourse but to resort to physical hard copy mail.
Okay, I appreciate it. That is much clearer. Chris?
Afternoon all. Chris Pelling for the transcript. As I mentioned last week, and unfortunately came out bluntly probably last week, and Don wasn't on the call, so I'll come out again probably the same way, unfortunately, because I have no other way of saying it. In some senses, I don't think we have any argument if LEA, as in law enforcement, you know, in our jurisdiction, sends us, as an example, a letter that needs to be forwarded on, and it's from law enforcement. I think a lot of points are made that, as Volker was saying, if it's general snail mail, it will probably go in the bin unless it's something that's really important, i.e. law enforcement. Now, as an example, and I mentioned this last week, if we receive a request to send something to a registrant, be it from, I don't know, whoever, we will ask and put forward that there is a charge of $30 to forward that on, and that is paid for by the requester, i.e. the person sending the document. It has to come via FedEx or has to come via UPS. It won't be accepted via snail mail. The reasoning for that is because this takes time, guys. You know, we're going to spend, as Volker was mentioning, not 5 or 10 minutes doing this. By the time you receive the mail, open it, take it to a scanner, play with a scanner, get it onto a stick, or send it direct to your desktop, whatever you want to do with it, and then relay that document, you are talking a man hour. Now, in the UK, we charge out man hours as £100 an hour. You've got to consider that if we are taking time to do this and there is a time involvement, there is obviously a charge. LEA, you know, in some senses that want to forward information, or I think it was David, I could be wrong, I do apologise, was saying that if he wanted a letter, a one-pager to go out, that's slightly different, I think, because obviously we're acting on LEA stuff, and that again is from our jurisdiction. That's all I wanted to point out. Thank you.
I might add just an idea, this is David, that a corresponding electronic proxy may be required.
David, you're breaking up pretty badly again.
I'll try one more time. I'm so sorry. I'm just in a bad place. And what I'm saying is that we could discuss a requirement that a parallel electronic communication has to go to the privacy proxy. So if they get a FedEx, they would have an electronic copy in their inbox as well that they could then forward and would not require them, you know. But in the end, if something is going to have to go to a physical location, I don't know a way around it. I mean, we could send a scan by email and with a request that says, please send this physically, we would be willing to discuss paying a fee for this. This is not something that happens frequently. I mean, we're really talking about, you know, we've got to the point now in many cases where we're thinking about litigating, and that's going to cost us tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't think in these serious IP infringement scenarios that paying a fee of, you know, whatever it is out of the question. I think that this is very infrequent, but it is, you know, without this recourse, we sort of hit a dead end.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, 2 points. First of all, I would just like to reiterate that failure of the registrant to respond to an email or communication does not equal undeliverable message or an inability to communicate with the registrant. If he chooses not to respond, that's his prerogative. To Steve's point, I agree that if the message bounces, then there's a problem. This is why most privacy proxy services, and I would propose this also as a standard for best actor or behavior for the providers that are accredited, is to have a separate abuse contact somewhere on their website in a prominent place that says, if you cannot communicate with the registrant because its email address bounces, or you think that we should be involved directly because we don't see what you sent to the registrant directly, then contact us at this abuse@whatever email address, and that way you can communicate with us and ask us any kinds of questions. I think that would solve that problem. And the last point, the address of the privacy proxy service is rather irrelevant. So checking that, I'm not sure if I understood David's point correctly. Checking the email address of the privacy proxy service by sending the physical address of the privacy proxy service by sending physical mail is irrelevant once those privacy proxy providers are accredited, because then that would already be checked by ICANN upon accreditation. So sending them postal mail and asking to forward does not fulfill any purpose other than making work for us, and that's why we refuse to do it.
Thanks. James? I'm sorry. Appreciate it. James?
Thanks. Sorry, I couldn't get the mute button to go off. I'm thinking, I'm going back, I think, to a couple of comments ago, and I think that the conversation may have passed up my question here a little bit, but there was a comment, I believe, from David regarding using Whois, and maybe I misunderstood, but using Whois to establish the physical location of the registrant. And I think that the thing that popped into my head there was that is precisely why some of these services are engaged, is so that law enforcement, and I'm thinking particularly here of areas where you know, the content of the website may be politically or religiously, persecuted or something like that. I mean, establishing the location would, you know, essentially undermine the value of the service. You know, certainly wouldn't want to hand over the physical location of a, you know, of one of our customers only to, you know, have them get their door kicked in by some group because of something they said on their website. So, you know, I think that, but I think that Volker, or perhaps it was Chris, yeah, it was Chris, said that it should be for the appropriate jurisdiction that's applicable to the proxy service. Now, to me, that makes a lot more sense, and I think that if we're going to establish that, then I think I'm okay with that particular concern. The operational, you know, one of the things that happens a lot in these calls is that I think we take too narrow of a view, and we really sometimes in ICANN circles don't appreciate the scale and the speed of the industry that we're talking about when we're dealing with perhaps you know, hundreds of thousands of domain names being looked up or created or altered every hour, and then we translate this into communication attempts. So when we deal with anything that's going to involve physical mail, that's going to significantly slow down the process. It's going to step out of an automated channel for many respects, and as I think Volker pointed out, step into a one that is very labor-intensive. So I think that there should, you know, if we're going to go down the path of requirements, then we should definitely, that must be accompanied by the ability for the registrar, the privacy proxy service, or perhaps the registrar, to recoup those costs from the sender, because that is going to be a significant issue, particularly if it's on the service's dime. And it's something that could be abused by spammers or even, you know, competing services. So just a couple of potpourri of thoughts there and collected during the long conversation, and I apologize if some of those topics have already passed me by and moved down the road. Thank you.
Okay. Wish we had more than 5 minutes left. I've got a few follow-up questions. There's no time, I'll send an email. McKaylee?
Yeah, thanks, Don. McKaylee again for the record. Agreeing with both James and Volker on this, I mean, the key thing here, I mean, this thing about physically sending something to somebody, I mean, ultimately, if you want to send a complaint about the user of a proxy or privacy service, you will have the proxy and privacy services full contact details. So if you want to send a registered letter or whatever to the proxy privacy service, you'll be able to do so. But you're not going to be able to do that to the user of the service, well, not directly, because as others have said, I mean, the entire point of having a proxy privacy service is not to divulge the end user, licensee, whatever you want to call them, to divulge their contact details. Now, for us as an Irish company, you know, you get me a court order from an Irish court, or if you're Irish law enforcement, and you send me in a properly formatted request, then we can have a conversation about that. But if you don't fall into either one, if you don't have a court order from an Irish court, or you're not Irish law enforcement, then you know you're going to have to communicate with us. Thanks.
This is David. I have a very quick comment. Maybe this will help.
David,
I don't know.
We've got two more people on the queue here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Keith?
Yes, I want to actually take James up on his invitation to step back a little bit here, and I would just encourage, remember, we're talking about Relay here, and we're going to talk about later about Reveal. Relay is one method of making Reveal unnecessary, not in every case, but in some cases, if you're able to contact the party that's engaging in abuse, you may not need to then go through the reveal process. You may be able to solve the problem. If the more that I hear the registrars on this call weakening the whole issue of reveal and making it more difficult to have an effective, of relay and have making it more difficult to have an effective relay. And, you know, again, these are the cases where we try to relay, but the relay, the address you the provider have, doesn't work. That's mostly what we're talking about here. But the more that you restrict the relay, or, you know, say there's no obligation to relay, which, again, I'm really kind of surprised to hear on this call, then you're going to increase pressure for reveal. I mean, I think it's just pretty obvious that relay is a less invasive, if you will, approach to this problem. So I would just encourage people, as you think about these issues over the week to come, and hopefully we'll have further discussion on the list, please think about this in that context, that if we don't have an effective relay procedure, then it increases pressure to have an effective reveal procedure and to make it more available in more circumstances. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Doug Volker?
Thank you, Steve. Like I said, I'm not opposed to relay. I think relay is important for our privacy service. We have always relayed certain communication, while others goes to the bin, as I've explained before. It's just to, I think we need to agree on what level of relay is appropriate and how that should be structured. That's, I think, the discussion that we should be having, not relay in general. Second point for the law enforcement, I think it makes sense to differentiate between law enforcement that are applicable. For example, we see law enforcement requests from all different kinds of jurisdictions, and while we are only bound by certain ones, for example, the ones that where our privacy proxy service is located, or the ones that where we are located, or where we are doing business with an physical office, those we treat as our own. And there's others that we receive and then we treat as a general abuse complaint, because they are not of jurisdiction, but we still look at what they're saying because it might still be relevant to our laws. And I would suggest that be borne in mind when discussing this topic as well.
Thanks. We're technically past 1 minute past 11. David, can you make your suggestion or go in your comment here, or would it be better on the list? I don't know how long it'll take.
Sorry. No, I think Steve clarified what I wanted to say, which is the differentiation between delay and reveal. And I think we got a note back that said we have relayed your physical hard copy and they have confirmed receipt. That's the end of the chain of relay and reveal a separate discussion. We're not asking you, please tell us the address of the person. We're saying, please confirm our correspondence. I think that's a big difference.
Okay, appreciate getting people kind of circling back towards each other as the call wraps up. Thanks very much for all of your involvement on the phone and in chat. This was a really productive hour and 2 minutes. I look forward to seeing everybody next week.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
And everybody else as well, of course.
Andre, if you can please stop recording. Once again.